There are two basic ways to look at the economy this week. Yay, things seem to finally be happening. Or, oh no, things seem to finally be happening. You decide. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, September the 15th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Never a dull moment, I'll tell you what. Somebody ought to print that on a hat or something. I don't know. We're going to dig right in with the week that was in this economy. Lynette Lopez is in New York. She is with Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. He is in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
Sudeep, let me start with you and ask you this question based on my open there about things finally seeming to be getting going. Speaker Ryan said today, and the president has also said, we're going to get something about taxes, some specificity about taxes the week of the 25th of September. Does it matter that we really still don't know much more than really broad outlines?
Yeah, we were supposed to have this whole thing wrapped up and done two months ago. We don't know a whole lot more.
Yeah, there's always a skeleton. Another skeleton and more skeletons, but no
look,
body.
This is going to be a long, messy process. Reality is just now starting to set in that they don't have the basics of where they're going to end up. So you have to agree on deductions for mortgage interest and state and local taxes and individual rates and corporate tax rates. And once you actually do that in an initial bill, you then get to deal with every interest group coming out and bringing their lobbying firepower for a fight to the finish, a death match over the only thing they care about, which is their tax rates and protecting their industries. That's going to happen.
Lynette, are you confident that we're going to get something when it has been promised?
So, lobbyists that I've talked to in D.C. say that they don't really expect to see anything real until December 23rd.
What?
There's
Really? December 23rd? But I've got plans for Christmas.
Yeah, they really don't think that this is going to – and people close to the administration that I've talked to, some say they don't ever even think it's going to happen at all. Think one of the things that people don't – aren't paying attention to is that the Freedom Caucus put out their own plan. It's way more radical and way more off base and unrealistic than anything that Trump people have put out themselves. Mm. And that means that the Freedom Caucus is probably going to try to bargain for some of these things. Right. And when they bargain for absolutes, and it tends to gum up the whole process. That's what it did with healthcare. And I think that this is a danger that people really aren't thinking about as much because they're watching the jockeying in the Gang of Six and asking to see stuff. It's, the Republicans are their own worst enemies right now. Right, you have to keep that in mind.
As we have totally seen all year. Sudeep, let me posit something here based on the deals that the president seems to be making or has made, depending on who you talk to, with Democratic leadership on Capitol Hill. I'm going to say this and I need your reaction. Bipartisanship is good for the economy. Discuss.
Partisans definitely disagree with that, and they will fight to maintain their views. But I think most Americans generally want to see some give and take so that we're not flinging from one direction to the other in policy decisions that create the uncertainty for the economy. That's what a lot of businesses are at least are more interested in getting closer to the middle ground or the common ground in between so that at least you can get a sense that you're not going to lurch after 4 years passes or 8 years pass and have to redo the whole thing and remake your business plans and reimagine how the economy is supposed to work. So, yes.
That was a long way to say yes. Bipartisanship is good for the economy, right?
People like to see things getting done. I think Americans are sick of gridlock. They want to see some compromise. They want to see movement. They want to feel like this government can do something.
Yeah. Lynette, let's take a little twist here. And I want to talk to you for a second about the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, who was in the news this week for a couple of things, all of which having to do with his use of government travel. First of all, the plane ride that he took down to Fort Knox to, in his words, inspect the gold there with his then fiancée, I believe, or his wife. And then also this report the other day that the Treasury Secretary asked to use a government plane for his honeymoon. It seems unusual, all of these activities by the Secretary of the Treasury.
It certainly does seem unusual. He is one of the Goldman Sachs guys in the White House. And there was always this tension between him and the populists, the Steve Bannon type guys who think that the Goldman guys are entitled, that they're aristocratic. And this isn't helping that image at all. Steve Mnuchin is a second generation Goldman guy. And, you know, this kind of paints that whole part of the White House in exactly the brush that people are afraid there. In fact, I wrote a piece a couple weeks ago, the Goldman guys are acting exactly like everyone feared they would. And this is part of that.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider and Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, it was higher, but nobody seemed very enthusiastic about it. Equifax, just to keep the eye on the consumer data ball, shares down 3% today, 34% since last Thursday when they told us about the hack. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Circling back to the Equifax hack here for just a second, there is a question to be asked. Actually, there are lots of questions to be asked, but time constraints force us to take them one at a time. So here is today's. You've got data for a gazillion Americans in your computers. And this isn't necessarily Equifax specific, by the way. It could be a hospital or a bank or a retailer. You've got all that data. Consumers have very little control other than trusting you to keep it safe. How hard is that? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on it.
It's hard, real hard.
It is a challenging environment. And every time I see a breach like this, your knees get a little bit weak.
Richard Ford is chief scientist at Forcepoint. If data were like actual physical gold bars, we could just put it in a vault, in a bunker, and call it a day. But that's not the point of data.
The fact is that we want to use this data. We want to be able to access it.
Your medical records, your credit reports, your apps, your online purchases, your web browsing habits, everything you do creates data for the purpose of being accessed by other people or entities. Fatima Katiblu is with Forrester Research.
But this means that the data is moving all over the place. And it's very, very difficult to monitor what's going on with that data and to keep that data protected.
But if you are, by chance, about to shed a tear for all the poor giant corporations out there who are having a hard time protecting your data, don't.
It really shouldn't be so hard.
Aviva Leighton is with Gartner Research. She says one thing companies can do besides lock up their data is use behavioral analytics to see if the people who are accessing data are acting fishy when they do it. Kind of like how your credit card company can spot a bizarre purchase or even how TripAdvisor can catch a fake review.
I think it's just a matter of companies aren't allocating enough resources to it.
Protecting data is totally doable, she says, but companies have to take it seriously from the top down. Leighton says if executive compensation were tied to security, there would be fewer breaches. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I know a guy up in San Francisco, did well with a company he started, now does a little angel investing on the side, and he is a very happy angel investor today, thanks to a very upscale coffee shop that he has a teeny tiny slice of. It is, as I said, a very upscale coffee shop. We learned yesterday a majority stake in Blue Bottle Coffee is going to be bought by Nestle, that Nestle, for $700 million. For a sense of scale here, Starbucks has 25,000 stores worldwide. Blue Bottle is on track to have just 55 cafes by the end of the year. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at what's in the deal for Nestle and for Blue Bottle.
If you don't live in a major market like San Francisco, Los Angeles, or New York, or you're not a fan of super fancy coffee, Blue Bottle might not ring a bell. But it has a fanatical following, and Nestle's investment in it is reportedly valued north of $400 million. Mike Myotel advises specialty food and beverage startups. He says most of them aim for an outcome like this.
When you see an acquisition of a small entrepreneur by a big company like Nestle's, it's sort of the dream of most of these guys. This is their paycheck.
And the Blue Bottle leadership gets to maintain some control. Myotel says Nestle could help Blue Bottle products get into more stores.
They've got big elbows. They can sort of shove their way onto the shelf.
Nestle is already the world's largest coffee producer with brands like Nescafe and Nespresso. But there's been a backlash against big food companies in recent years. Sales are down for many of them. Jim Hertel is with the consultancy Inmar's Willard Bishop Analytics. He says specialty or craft products, including coffee, can give those companies a boost.
And that's really what's driving this, is how do we reignite growth?
Nestle has also recently acquired a frozen vegetarian food startup and a healthy food delivery service. But Blue Bottle's chic could suffer in this deal. Hertel remembers when organic cereal maker Kashi was bought by Kellogg. It initially moved to Kellogg's headquarters in Michigan,
but ultimately concluded that the company had lost some of its vibe, and they moved them back out to Los Angeles, which was where they were started.
He says both sides go in knowing that losing that special vibe is a risk. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you're talking 10,000, 18,000 watts for a single light. That's as much as, you know, a full office building is using sometimes.
Saving the planet one powerful but very efficient light bulb at a time. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 64 points today, 0.2%, closed at 22,268. The NASDAQ up 19 points, 0.3%, 6448. The S&P 500 up 0.4%, 2,500 on the nose. For the week, the Dow Industrial is up 2.1%, the NASDAQ up 1.3%, S&P 500 up 1.5%. Equifax, we told you about, terrible. TransUnion down 3.4%. Experian traded in London, lost 0.8%. Also a big week for Apple, finally revealing its iPhone X. That's what I'm going to call it, just because. Also various bits of tech gadgetry. On that day, the market kind of shrugged, shares went down. Today, shares finally moved upward, added about 1% or so. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.20%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You know those warnings you hear before a story that's got objectionable content in it? This is one of those stories. ProPublica had the news yesterday that Facebook's ad buying programs let people buy ads targeted at really specific kinds of people. And here comes the language. Jew haters is one representative category. For $30, ProPublica reporters were able to buy ads on Facebook targeted to those kinds of people and others. Julia Angwin shared the byline on the story. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Give me the methodology, would you? How'd you go about this?
Well, what happened was we got a tip that said that there was this category you could buy of ads on Facebook called Jew Hater, and there was a screenshot. And I thought, that seems phony. Like, if we try to buy an ad in this category, it won't go through.
Yeah.
So we bought an ad, and then it went through. And then I was like, that didn't really happen. So we did it again, and then it went through. And then we did a third. And by that time, I was convinced that they were selling a category called Jew Haters. So then I called them and said, what's going on?
Did any human hands touch these ads before they went up, or was it all algorithm?
I don't know for sure, right? Facebook doesn't disclose exactly how it works behind the screen,
yeah,
but it seems as though it's entirely automated. So if you write on your profile that you're interested in the topic of Jew hating, the Facebook algorithm automatically converts that without any thought process into an ad buying category. And then when we chose it from their little menu, I don't know that any human looked at it, but it sailed on through.
Huh. You mentioned an important point there, and I want to make sure we all understand this. Our profiles, our likes, our shares, everything we do on Facebook somehow gets compiled into an advertising category.
Yes, that is correct. Everything we do is compiled. So there's the things we explicitly state, like I am this person, I like this music. Those are made into categories. And then the things you do behavior-wise are analyzed and made into categories.
Yeah. It turns out there are not enough. I can't believe these words are coming out of my mouth. There are not enough Jew haters to make an advertisable category. So you had to throw some other things on there, basically.
Yes. Right? I don't know what constitutes like an advertisable category,
yeah,
but they told us that there were, you know, about 2,200 Jew haters, but they suggested we add additional categories to get to the threshold that would be allowed for an ad buy. So they suggested to us some categories such as how to burn Jews, why Jews ruin the world. They actually suggested the Second Amendment. I don't know why, if their machine has learned that those things are correlated, but we decided to try some other categories. So we put in Nazi Party and the German SS and just, you know, trying to go with the anti-Semitic theme.
Yeah.
Until we got to the threshold that they said would be enough for an ad buy.
You have to believe that this was algorithmic, right? It's not, I mean, I suppose it's possible, but it's not possible. There's a human employee at Facebook saying, no, let's throw in how to burn Jews.
Yeah, I feel like this is algorithmic. Okay. And I think we know from what Facebook has said this morning, which is that they said they're going to turn off the automatic algorithm that turns all your expressed interests, the things that you self-identify on your profile, into ad categories. So it sounds like that was a, you know, an automated process.
Okay, so here comes the question then, based on Facebook turning this off, that is going to get the complaints and the mean tweets at me. And it goes like this. If I, in a capitalist economy, want to advertise to Jew haters, who is Facebook to stop me from doing that?
Well, that's a really good question, right? I mean, the tech platforms are in this confusing space right now where they, for a long time, argued like everything goes on our platform, right? Like we have no legal liability. We got this special exemption under the 1996 Telecom Act that actually gives us no liability for the content on our platforms. Post Charlottesville, I think a lot of the tech platforms have taken more steps saying, like, you know, we want this to be a safe space. So we're going to try to get rid of some of the, you know, Nazi elements. But they're authoritarian regimes. You know, they can do whatever they want. We all are there and they can make the rules.
You take this episode and then the episode from a week, 10 days ago about revelations of Russians buying advertising on Facebook in pursuit of swaying the election. Congress is going to want to talk to Mark Zuckerberg, I imagine. You can see how Zuckerberg's not real anxious to let Congress peek under the hood of his algorithm.
Yeah, you know, I understand, like, Facebook is really not excited about sharing these Russian ads, right? They said, look, we found them. We're disclosing it to you, and that should be enough for you, the public, right? What people are saying is like, no, this is important political discourse. I think that debate about what amount of transparency is appropriate is one that will probably be long fought.
Right. And the need here is because Facebook is proprietary, shall we say.
Yeah, it's a closed platform. You know, it's not like Twitter where you can sort of search and see everything is pretty much public there. But Facebook, you really just see what Facebook thinks you want to see, and then ads that are targeted specifically at you at very tiny categories, like, for instance, Jew hater.
Julia Angwin at ProPublica with some interesting stuff behind the scenes at Facebook. Julia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There's a part of L.A. just east of downtown called the Arts District. Once run down, it's now trendy and increasingly expensive. In there between the lofts and the art galleries, though, might just be the future of the green economy. Oh, my God, it's a high school chemistry class.
Isn't it?
Oh, it totally is.
Yeah.
All right, it's better than a high school chemistry class. It's the L.A. Clean Tech Incubator, LACI for short. There's a fancy tech campus complete with a solar-covered parking lot to charge your EV, built with a mix of government and private grants supplying the infrastructure the clean tech companies need to get to that next level. CEO Matt Peterson explained the other day how companies can get in the door.
So we invite portfolio companies to apply online, and then we take a review of what they're doing and meet the founders, talk to them on the phone or meet with them in person, and then go through a committee process we have once a week, you know, looking at their business model, at, you know, what the product they're making or their business plan. But it's also about meeting the founders because, as you know, in startups, it's a lot about the personality and the vision they have and the drive they have as founders of the company.
Once you and your selection committee in their weekly meeting says, yes, you're in, then what?
Well, we pair them with an executive in residence who's got experience in starting up a business up from the corporate level, or maybe they're an angel investor and they've seen lots of startups struggling to make it, and what made them succeed and what made others fail. So we pair them, and once a week they meet with them, and it's, you know, accountability, it's business coaching, it's sometimes life coaching as, you know, founders struggle with relationships and how they're working together. So it's all of that. And then we try to provide them the services here that they need. We'll keep going. This is our, you know,
cafeteria. Got
so
it.
You see, this, we've got our own sort of co-working culture and space we've created here. It's one of our, you know, core functions besides the portfolio companies. Well, I'm going to walk you over and talk to Tracy Gray, who's one of our executives in residence and is also leading up our diversity inclusion initiative.
Introduce yourself to the microphone, would you?
I'm Tracy Gray. I'm an executive in residence here at LACI.
What does that mean?
I help companies in every aspect of their businesses, from their business model to their financials to their strategy, customer acquisition, you name it.
Give me your resume. Give me the elevator pitch.
Started as an engineer on the space shuttle program back in the early 90s. Went into venture capital. And now I'm starting my own firm, venture capital firm.
So when Matt comes to you and says, hey, listen, I've got these folks I need you to work with, how do you do that?
Make sure they understand their business and the market they're going into. I look at diversity, too. I'm very interested in women and minorities coming into the tech space.
What are you finding, actually, on that?
Finding that you have to be very intentional to find them. Like I said, I started in the late 90s, black woman, engineer.
I was just going to say, when it was a different thing for a black woman in the hard sciences.
It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed much. Yeah. And there are entrenched point of views that there's a pipeline problem, but it's not my pipeline problem. I can find people from that look like me in my pipeline, but there's a very small pipeline up in Silicon Valley. And so what we're doing is we're really trying to reach out intentionally and gather in this space and bring in this space people that look like Los Angeles, very diverse, and it can be successful.
We're going to walk you into our advanced prototyping center.
Oh, yeah.
This is really amazing. You know, it's not just this cool space that's got all these great fun bells and whistles.
You've got cool gadgets, too?
We've actually got cool gadgets.
Great. Yeah. Precision water jet?
Yes,
I'd like to go there.
Welding and
can I see the precision
water
jet?
Absolutely.
Laser cutting and 3D printing shop. I'd like to go there too.
Electronics lab. So why don't we walk you through?
Let's go poke around.
Yeah, this one's fun. Yeah, I've never seen it in operation.
What are we doing?
Whoa!
Yes, yeah, CNC lathe. So we've got large format 3D printers, of course, laser cutters. Are we talking to the hive?
Yeah, my guess is that's it.
There he is. This is really exciting. This is.
Hey,
one
how are
of
you?
Our.
I'm Kai.
John Miller.
Good to see you, John. How are you?
Good. Nice to meet you.
What is Hive Lighting?
So Hive Lighting does high-performance, energy-efficient lighting. Primarily, we work in the entertainment industry, so film, television, photography.
Help me understand how entertainment lighting is clean technology. Is there something special about the light bulbs?
Yeah, so we take a different approach to it. Traditionally, entertainment lighting is not clean technology. It's quite the opposite. It uses very large incandescent light bulbs. Yeah. So you're talking 10,000, 18,000 watts for a single light. Yeah. That's as much as, you know, a full office building is using sometimes. However, the approach that Hive Lighting has taken is to use energy-efficient light sources like LED, take that, use between 50 to 75% less power to actually get a higher performance. But we're talking about like lighting up city blocks.
So you came here, you got the support, and you got the company up and running. How long between the time you got here and you were selling these things or renting? I guess you're probably selling too, right?
So we manufacture and sell.
Yeah.
So we're actually an American manufacturing company. We do. We started here with LICI actually almost 4 years ago. This is our newest project. And began development on this in July of last year.
Huh.
We were able to bring it to market by March of this year, which is incredibly fast.
Is that pretty fast?
That's really fast for a manufacturing product. Okay. And that was only possible because of the Advanced Prototyping Center, which is where we're at. And that's because we were able to take the basic schematics that we were able to draw here on the CAD lab. Right. So we were able to design it here, prototype it through milling and through 3D printing.
Here in this room?
Here in
space,
this room.
With these machines. Wow, that's
exactly.
Cool. Good deal. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
so much.
Appreciate it.
There must be 10,000, as a conservative guess, entrepreneurs in L.A. who would love to be in this space.
Yeah. So we invite them to apply. I mean, we can't succeed without that fuel, nor can the portfolio companies. Yeah. So we're creating jobs here in Los Angeles and the region. And, you know, L.A. is the best known brand of any city in the world. We want to attract people here that want to create the green revolution, not just come to Hollywood and make the next big movie hit at a blockbuster hit.
Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Guy. I appreciate you being here.
This final note on the way out today, which you can file under what a long, strange trip it has been. Today is the 15th of September, as I said up at the top. Ordinarily not a noteworthy marker, except for this. Today makes it 9 years since Lehman Brothers went under. CNBC's Carl Quintanilla pointed out this morning that the S&P 500 is up 109% in those 9 years. Also today in 2008, by the way, which I suppose you'd file under barn door closed, horse gone, Standard & Poor's took Lehman Brothers out of the S&P 500 9 years ago today. All right, Friday, we got to go. The Dow up 64 points, 0.2%. NASDAQ up 19, 0.3%. S&P 500 up 4, about 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Cesar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourself a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.